May it please the court, Eric Davis on behalf of appellant Cornelia Madry on appeal from an order entered by the Superior Court of Newcastle County. Wouldn't tell from the audience today, but I believe it's pretty narrow issues that are before the court, a limited appeal. We believe it comes down to three issues from the court's order. One that we didn't initially brief in our opening brief with respect to jurisdiction, but was raised by the appellee in their brief, and since it goes to subject matter jurisdiction, I think it's one that the court should address. Plus, there does appear to be different authorities on the same subject coming from the same courts, and it would be good to get guidance from this court as to which jurisdiction or which court of jurisdiction is the right court of competent jurisdiction, either the Superior Court or the Court of Common Pleas for a writ of certiorari from the JP Court. We have the Chelsea decision. We have the last statement that Judge Carpenter put in our opinion, as opposed to the Howell case and the In Re Department, Delaware State Department housing case, which seem to show that the Superior Court has retained jurisdiction over writs of certiorari. I know that there are counsel here today who are interested in that particular issue, and it was one of the issues that when we brought the case in the first instance to the Superior Court was important to us. Where do we go on a writ of certiorari? The other issues relate to a legal question with respect to what is the appropriate standard of proof for the determination that the lease has been breached, either pursuant to the lease or under this law, under the Delaware Code. And then the final issue is as to the admissibility of the investigator's report. I want to start with the jurisdictional question because I don't think it really goes into questions of fact, just the question of which court. There are different authorities as to where you can take a writ of certiorari. There's no ability to appeal a decision from the JP Court, no right of appeal. According to Urban, you must take the decision on a writ of certiorari to the next court of competent jurisdiction. Previously, it was taken to the Superior Court. Then there was a statutory grant under the Court of Common Pleas, an extension of authority there that makes it seem a little that it's concurrent with the Superior Court on this issue. And since that time, we've had the Chelsea decision from Judge Del Pesco, which said that filing a writ of certiorari from a decision from the JP Court is wrong. To file it in the Superior Court should be filed in the Court of Common Pleas. We have the Howell decision by a Superior Court saying no, a writ of certiorari is appropriate to be filed in the Superior Court, that Chelsea is limited to its facts. And then we have a decision here from the court that's not directly on point, but is the In Re Petition versus Delaware State Housing Authority for a writ of prohibition, in which this court said, when we believe that a court has jurisdiction, we're not going to step in and impose a writ of prohibition. That was a decision from the JP Court to the Superior Court on a writ of certiorari, so we felt that that actually answered the question. But at the very least, from today, it would be helpful to the bar if we knew where to go on these writs of certiorari. It's important because the summary possession process is very quick.
We agree it's important. Which way should we go and why?
I think it's concurrent. I think you could go to either court. I believe that the jurisdiction of the Superior Court is general jurisdiction. There's no prohibition with respect to that grant from a writ of certiorari. I think the Court of Common Pleas by statute is also broad enough to take it initially. The worry comes where you file it in the Superior Court, and depending on the judge, you get kicked off to the Court of Common Pleas. And again, dealing with the summary possession matter, timing is important. Whether you get some type of stay to maintain residence, moving those decisions along to file your writ of certiorari, then have it dismissed, and then going back and filing, even under the statutory right of having it relate, you're still in a situation where time is run.
If we accept the premise that was instilled in many of us through Woolley, that a writ of certiorari is a common law inherited writ from England, and that the reason the appeals in the past went to the Superior Court was because the Superior Court was the court of general jurisdiction. Now that the legislature has spoken by statute and given jurisdiction to the Court of Common Pleas, why isn't it persuasive that that statute's in derogation of the common law and from that statute's enactment date forward, jurisdiction over writs of certiorari from the JP court go to the Court of Common Pleas?
Well, I would think for two reasons. One, there's no specific grant in the grant to the Court of Common Pleas saying the writ of certiorari should only go to the Court of Common Pleas. And two, there's no limitation at the same time on the Superior Court's general jurisdiction grant. So even, I would say, it should have been addressed in the statute if they were taking away some type of jurisdiction by the Superior Court.
Well, I rather suspect that the 60 legislators who are not attorneys weren't aware of the existence of Woolley or the distinction between the common law and statutory pronouncements. So what do we infer from the fact that this statute's silent other than to give jurisdiction over writs of certiorari to the Court of Common Pleas?
Again, I would in this situation, a determination of where we go is what we need. It's not, we don't believe it's fatal to our decision, because then if the Court of Superior Court didn't have jurisdiction to grant, we asked for the statutory right to go to the Court of Common Pleas. If the Superior Court didn't have, then we should be going back to the Court of Common Pleas right now and rebriefing the matter. I don't think, what I think is important, I think one of the reasons we have the audience that we have is there are various decisions out there right now.
I think we appreciate that, and I think we understand it needs to be resolved, and I was just looking for help to do it in the right direction.
And again, I don't think there's any specific authority that you can point to by the legislature that would have revoked jurisdiction from the Superior Court.
I understand your point.
The next issue would be the one relating to what we considered a question of law, but which the Superior Court basically summarily dismissed as an argument with respect to findings of fact below. In that instance, we're not good at arguing these types of matters before the court, but we thought we were setting up as a question of law. We understand that a writ of certiorari is limited to the three points that it's limited to, and we understand that we cannot ask on a writ of certiorari. We would have loved to ask for findings with respect to fact. I think the factual record here is very sparse and shouldn't have supported it, but we're not entitled to make that argument. All we could argue on the factual record is nothing on the factual record, but whether they applied the appropriate burden of proof. Assuming, if you look at the record as a whole, which this court is allowed to do on questions of law, it's not limited to
Well, isn't your argument, I mean, turning specifically to this case, that the record made in connection with the cert has to show, or at least has to be sufficient to support a finding of an actual breach of the lease, that there was actually a violent act that was committed
by
someone in the household, as distinguished from the fact that someone who lived in the household was arrested for a violent act.
And the fact that there's no evidence what violent act they were arrested for.
Okay.
I think the only thing in the record that would have shown what violent act they were arrested for was a newspaper article from the News Journal. There's no testimony in the record as to what they were arrested for.
Fair enough.
And our point would be...
Your point is, if I understand the argument correctly, and tell me if I'm wrong, is that the burden... that was required to have been met was the burden to show that there was in fact a violent act committed by someone who was in the household.
Correct, and we don't believe that means a conviction, but we also don't mean it means a mere arrest. We believe that you need somebody with personal knowledge or a document that shows that the arrest was for the conduct complained of. The way we frame it is that there's reasonable suspicion, which allows a search. There's probable cause that allows for an arrest. My understanding of probable cause is it's what a reasonable person would believe that an event has occurred, a criminal act has occurred, so for which an arrest warrant can be issued. It's not admissible in a trial as to prove the facts below. It can be built on hearsay within hearsay. It all has to do is to get to the level of probable cause. The next level, and these cases we cited the cases in the next level, is preponderance of the evidence. We think the classic examples of the difference between arrest and preponderance of the evidence is the administrative proceedings with respect to DUIs. at the administrative proceeding, to take away someone's license, you just have to meet a preponderance of the evidence standard. You don't have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that they were driving under the influence at the time of the incident. In those situations, an arrest record is not enough. You have to actually provide evidence that carries the burden of proof, which is preponderance.
The if I understand correctly, the ruling of the Superior Court judge, his view of what the court was required to do in a certiorari proceeding is decide and only to decide whether or not the investigative report should have been admitted into evidence. Once it was admitted to evidence, then the weight of the evidence or the sufficiency of the evidence was not an issue that was cognizable on cert.
And that would be our fault, because that's not how we were arguing it. We would argue that...
Well, you're saying that it is cognizable. That is, the weight of the evidence, the sufficiency.
If you assume an arrest was proved, let's throw the report out. Let's say Ms. Madre's testimony that she's aware that Camille Madre was arrested.
Before we get into the testimony, maybe it would be good for you to tell us your understanding of what the record is in a writ of certiorari, because many of our cases going back almost 30 years to Kastner talk about the record being limited. So what are the limitations on the record in a certiorari proceeding?
Well, I'm not going to try and bluff my way. I'm not necessarily sure I know exactly the full limitations. I know that the issues that can be brought before it are with respect to whether a court is properly exercising jurisdiction,
right,
whether it made a manifest error of law, or whether it is proceeded irregularly.
I would think all of those have to be discernible, according to the term in the cases, from the face of the record. But traditionally, in a certiorari proceeding, you don't look at testimony.
Correct. And I understand that. And I do think that that's where the record is, and if that's what the court was asking, I do believe that. But I also know that on questions of law, it's not limited to not looking at the record as a whole. So if a certiorari writ allows the court to determine whether an error of law was made, then the court can therefore look at the record as a whole. I do not believe, and I think the reason you were stopping me was because I was going into individual testimony, and you think that's beyond what the writ of certiorari would allow. Well, what I was trying to use was...
Just my impression.
Yes. And believe me, I would love to argue this case on the facts, but my point was, but let's assume that there's an arrest without getting to the report of Mr. O'Rourke. Let's assume there's an arrest, you're taking the testimony of somebody. We're saying the mere fact of proving an arrest is not enough to meet the legal standard of burden of proof. And that's where I think we may have made the mistake. Even if you let in O'Rourke's report, Mr. O'Rourke's report, showing an arrest, there's nothing in the report that actually shows that he had personal knowledge that the act occurred.
I understand that.
And where it occurred. And when it occurred.
I think we all understand that point. The question is that fact something that we can take cognizance of on a certiorari, in a certiorari proceeding?
Not specific facts, I believe, on a writ of certiorari. Well, I think you can take a look at the record as a whole, proving an arrest, and say from that fact, it doesn't meet the burden of proof.
It gets back to what the record is, Justice Holland's question. Is it the entirety of what was presented to the three-judge JP court?
I believe it is the entirety.
Is there any authority either in Delaware or elsewhere?
We cite in our opinion, or not our opinion, sorry, Your Honor. There was a case where we're talking about, Shahan v. Landing, which was affirming a decision of the Superior Court rejecting narrow view of its power of review in an appeal of an administrative. Although factual findings are limited to record review, the determination of probable cause remains a question of law subject to de novo review. And in that sense, in that decision, the court said we can't go into specific findings and whether the court made a proper determination. What we do is look at the record as a whole. What was proved, and does that meet the standard of probable cause subject to de novo review?
There's a... interesting cite from Woolley in discussing what a court may reverse for on certiorari. And the statement is, but on a certiorari, the court may reverse for want of jurisdiction for not proceeding in the manner the law directs. And here's the interesting part. And perhaps for admitting and deciding on illegal evidence alone, if this appears, and punish the justice for neglect. It may not answer the question of what the record or portion of the record can be considered, but it sounds like at least as early as 1837, our courts were considering if evidence appeared in the actual record sent up on certiorari that addressed admitting and deciding on the admission of evidence, that that's something that can be reviewed by the court.
Well, we can go to that point, and we're coming in the sum-up part, but we can talk about Mr. O'Rourke's report and why we believe it should not have been admitted. First of all, one of the things that's baffled me is that that two courts have held that it's admissible as a public document under 803.8. We cited to the Butler case with respect to that. A private document that contains public records does not raise itself up to being a public record. Public records have to be documents created by a public agency, either pursuant to its regular proceedings or a statute. That does not qualify Mr. O'Rourke in this situation, or does not apply to Mr. O'Rourke. Mr. O'Rourke is a private investigator. His document cannot be a public record. Now, the question is whether his attachments are public records. Here, we're not attacking the notion that Delgis is not a public record. What we're saying here is it's not admissible because it hasn't been properly authenticated. One, it's not certified. It's a very easy thing to do under 105. You can get a certified copy, or you can have somebody testify that they went down, they got a copy, and they compared it to the original. We believe the testimony here was he went down, he looked at a screen, he pressed the print button, it prints up, he grabs it, and he leaves. He pays a dollar page instead of $6 for a certified copy. There's no testimony that he then compared the copy to the original documents. There's no testimony that he took the information from the Delgis and compared it to the original arrest record. In that situation, you don't meet the standard under Delaware Rule of Evidence 1005, which requires either a certified copy or a witness that testifies they took the copy, uncertified, and compared it to the original. At best, he has a memory of what was on the screen, but he doesn't say that he compared that copy to the original, and there's no testimony that he compared the information from Delgis to the actual arrest report itself to determine whether that was accurate. In that situation, I'm sorry.
I think we grasp that point, but getting back to your second point, how, if at all, or to what extent, is this proceeding, which is nominally a certiorari proceeding, before us different from an appeal?
On the question of evidence? I think question on of admission anything. Of evidence is...
On anything. That is, in what way is this proceeding distinguishable from an appeal? A certiorari is a writ of a limited writ. That is, at least in theory, it's supposed to constrain the ability of a court to review. The writ that gives this court the full ability to review is an appeal.
Correct.
We're not on appeal. So
we're on appeal from the writ of certiorari.
We are. But
whatever
restraints or constraints exist at the in the original proceeding presumably bind us as well. So my question is, how is this case different in terms of what we consider from a normal appeal?
Well, in this issue, it's a question of law. I mean, the Judge Carpenter, I do believe, addressed the standard of whether or not it was appropriate to determine whether the report was admissible, and that it was a question of law, and therefore within the purviews of a writ of certiorari, and we're appealing from that. I mean, I may be being obtuse on this, but the one question, we do believe that the Superior Court properly ruled that addressing the issue of whether the report was admissible or not is a question of law.
Let me cut through this. On appeal, there are only three arguments that can be made. The first is that the trial judge selected the wrong rule of law, which is an issue of law. The second is that the trial judge selected the right rule of law but applied it wrongly to the facts. That's also an issue of law. And the third is that the trial judge found the facts incorrectly. I gather you're arguing that argument cannot be made on cert.
Right. I would say it would be the second argument, taking the question of as a matter of law. Time is up.
You may complete your answer.
Oh, as a matter of law, the first question is whether it should have been admitted in the first instance, not going to the facts, but whether it met to satisfy the standard for admitting under 8038 and then also authentication through 1005. Those were questions of law that do require some factual review, but not findings of fact. They're there on the record. That differs from the question of whether they proved at trial credibility issues, let's say. This doesn't go to credibility or things like that.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. If it pleases the court, my name is Michael Morton. I'm here on behalf of the appellee. If I might be so forward as to attempt to answer a question that was asked by the panel, in terms of reference to what is the record, going to Woolley's section 902 references the fact that at that time there was a statutory obligation for the Justice of the Peace Court upon request and payment to tender a true transcript of all the docket entries of any cause before him and a certified transcript of the record of any judgment or proceeding that the JP had before him was to be sent to the court for whom the writ of cert was being sought. If you go to section 903, it elaborates on that and says that each of the judges of the Superior Court shall have the authority to frame and issue writs of cert and all remedial writs, and they shall be granted based on the record below. I hope that is at least partially responsive to the question.
Well, then, as I understand it, the record for purposes of a writ of certiorari is a list of the docket entries and the order that was entered at the end of the case. Therefore, the question is, if we looked at the docket entries in this case, would we find a notation that this expert's report was offered into evidence?
I believe on the docket entries, on the first page of the docket entries, the court's finding references the fact that they ruled on the motion in limine and specifically referenced the fact that they had made a finding, a law finding, that his testimony was proper and the documents that he submitted were proper. I don't want to get caught up in the limitation in the form of the question, with all due deference. I believe that the common practice has been for quite some time that when the court below, in this case the Justice of the Peace Court, sends a transcript of the record up, they send everything in their file. And I think if you look at the appendix to the appellant's initial request for a petition, it's that black binder right there. It's 4 inches thick, and it has every exhibit, all the notes on the transcript from the court. By that, I mean on the docket that the court made, because they make a notation on the docket, and then they also issue a formal order.
Well, your earlier recitation from 902 and 903 included the phrase transcript of the proceedings.
It does. It did, Your Honor.
In addition to docket entries and the order of the court.
That's correct. It does.
So can we conclude from that that 4-inch thick, what's between the leaves of that folder, that binder, may properly be considered by the Superior Court of the Court of Common Pleas on a certiorari proceeding and by us on appeal?
Justice Jacobs, I believe that would be true within the confines of the Reese case and the Christiana Town Center case that says, here's what the scope of review is. That's the record. I don't have a dispute with that.
Okay, we can consider that. We can consider everything that's in that record, subject to whatever the confines there may be in terms of what we can do with that record. That is how we can...
I believe that's accurate.
All right. And what are those confines? That is, what are our limits? You know, in what way are we, and in what way would the Superior Court be limited that in contrast to what it would be empowered to do on a full appeal?
I'll be happy to answer that, Your Honor, to the best of my ability. There is a significant distinction between an appeal and a writ of cert. The two cases where this court, in fact, several members of this court sat on the decisions, and Christiana Town Center versus Newcastle and Reese versus the Board of Building Appeals, this court ruled that a review on cert is not the same as appeal, that the Superior Court cannot weigh evidence, they cannot review the lower court's factual findings. The job is very limited. It is, did they exceed their jurisdiction, did they commit errors of law, or did they proceed irregularly? That's the case from 2000. The later case is perfectly consistent with that, I would suggest, Your Honor, and that is that in the Christiana Town Center case, it was a review of a board. The board ruled that the developer had done something intentionally. And the argument before the Superior Court was that they had offered no evidence at all, the moving party, in support of that finding. And this court ruled, after considering that, that the board made a factual finding. This was a factual determination made by the board, which shall not be disturbed upon cert review. So I would suggest respectfully that what the appellant is trying to do is bootstrap this argument and say, we don't want you to deal with factual issues, but the only way you get to our argument is by dealing with factual issues.
Is that fair? You agree, I assume everybody agrees that the court, the Superior Court, and presumably we in review can consider whether or not it was error to admit into evidence the O'Rourke report.
I don't question the court's ability to do that at all.
Oh, okay. The question that's posed by the other side is whether, under that same line of reasoning, the Superior Court could have and should have, once it determined that the report was properly in evidence, should have determined whether or not that report, which apparently is all that there was on the issue of breaching the lease, was legally sufficient.
Let me answer the last part of that first with all due deference, Your Honor. I do not accept, nor I believe the record indicates, that that was the only thing in the record to support the finding of the court. The court, in its finding, said a number of interesting things. A reference was made to it in passing by my respective counsel, and that is...
All right, well, let me amend the question so that I can get the answer. Whatever it was that was presented in term as proof of a breach of the lease, wasn't the Superior Court entitled to determine or empowered to determine on a writ for certiorari whether the quantum of that evidence and the quality of it was sufficient to establish grounds for eviction, that is, a breach of the lease?
The answer, I think, is no, because to do that in the way that's suggested by the way this question has been framed by the appellant would be to weigh the evidence. That's the only way this court could make the determination that's required to decide if it was appropriate to put the evidence in. And that is...
Well, but let me interrupt you for a moment. I understand what you mean by weighing evidence when we're talking about how that evidence should be resolved one way or the other in terms of a fact finding. That's one mental process. But a quite different mental process is to take all of the evidence that was admitted, whatever it might be, and decide whether the sum total of it adds up to a finding of a breach of the lease. It doesn't require weighing anything. It's just adding and then asking, inquiring whether that evidence reaches the whatever the threshold is.
Well, let me use a different word picture, Your Honor. I think it is weighing it this way. Is it sufficient evidence to prove the case or not? And that requires you to weigh it, as opposed to how high it stacks up. And I think there's a significant difference. It's not just a wordplay.
So when a court decides whether there's enough evidence to go to a jury on a motion for a directed verdict, is it weighing evidence? I mean, it sounds like it would be based on your concept.
Well, I have difficulty applying the concept since that would be an appeal as opposed to a writ of cert. the standards for our appeal are significantly different. In many of those, it's a de novo review. That's far broader than what we're talking about today. So putting it in that context, I believe.
On a motion for summary judgment, the court has to determine whether a prima facie case has been made out to warrant going to a jury or a fact finder. Is that a weighing process?
I think it is. And I understand the court may disagree with me.
Well, is the admissibility of the records that were provided by the private investigator an issue for us on appeal of a writ certiorari?
Well, I would suggest that based on what Judge Carpenter decided, it is the issue, that his perspective, the court's perspective below, was that the other argument was strictly an effort to get him to weigh the evidence, to go beyond the limited scope of review, and therefore he went directly to the admissibility of the evidence and ruled, to the extent that the court's not already read this, which I presume they have, that based on the clear reading of the rules and of the opinion below, where the court had in front of it a motion and full argument on the motion in limine, that the court decided properly that it was a public record. Now, we have at this point now broken it down to five or six other subparts where it's a public record, or is it a business record that qualifies under some other section, but the way it was framed in JP court and the initial discussion in Superior Court was, does it qualify as a public record? And Judge Carpenter and the three-judge panel below said, yes, it does. It's exactly what is meant by public record. We use it.
And can you elaborate on why that's the case? Because what we see in your opponent's brief is that the report is not a public record, even though the report is based upon public records and includes as attachments or exhibits the public records. And that's the distinction that your opponent's trying to make.
And I understand it, Justice Holland. I think the true distinction, if there's one at all, is the one I believe we tried to make in our brief, was it's a summary and the attachments. His report, Judge Carpenter ruled that his report was not in any way different than the attachment. It simply summarized what was attached, that is, the court docket and prior proceedings.
Can you
interrupt
just a minute? I won't penalize you for the loss of time, but I'd ask one of the law clerks to please go out of the courtroom and tell the noisemakers outside to shut up. I could have said it more politely, but it's been going on too long.
Did I fully respond, Your Honor?
You did, although I'd like you to elaborate, because, you know, if we look at what we traditionally see, which is a certified copy of a public record, the certification would say, I certify this as X record. And what you seem to be suggesting is, even though this document has been characterized as a report, it basically is an individual who said, attached to my letter are what I found in the public records, or words to that effect.
I believe it's a little, what he said was a little more cogent than that, Your Honor, even though that's what's been argued by the other side. First off, I don't think that under 803.8 there is a requirement in the clear language of 803.8 that in any way anyone certify or testify about it. It's strictly geared towards the extent of records, reports, statements, data compilations prepared in any form of a public office or agency. I don't believe there can be a genuine argument that records prepared of court proceedings, they are not investigative. They don't contain allegations of facts. They simply are recording the events of the court. It's the classic definition of a public record. His testimony in the court below was, you go to the terminal at the courthouse, and they print it out. And the only difference between what I got and a certified copy is I didn't pay $5 a page to get the certification. And the Justice of the Peace Court, in its opinion, also references the fact that right now someone could go outside of this chamber and go to the front desk and get exactly the same thing from the state-provided system.
Mr. Morton, I understand your position is that the JP Court properly admitted the report, that is, the investigative report. Let's assume that's correct. There's still the argument made by the other side that even if that report is, you know, fully credited, was properly admitted, it still doesn't prove anything other than the fact that the grandson of Mrs. Madry was arrested for a violent crime. Doesn't show that that any such crime was in fact committed or committed by the grandson. And it's the latter that has to be shown, at least by a preponderance of the evidence, in order to establish a breach of the lease. What is your response to that argument?
My response to that, Your Honor, would be in two parts. The first is that the record, that is, what the JP Court found below, was included things like the newspaper articles that were referenced before and the testimony of the defendant directly where she acknowledged that arrest, that it had occurred. That the other issue is that the court below pointed out that there had never even been a contest raised as to whether or not it satisfied the burden on cause or threat to cause irreparable harm to person or property.
You're saying. So far, we all agreed that there was an arrest. Or at least an arrest was shown.
Well, the finding of the court in the first couple lines of the court is broad enough, I think, if the court gives me liberty to read it. It has about 9 major findings, and it finds, as a matter of fact, under the determination of facts, that on or about March 17th, there was a shooting incident involving defendant's grandson, Quamir Madre, and Anthony White, the boyfriend of the defendant's grandmother. That's the first thing. There was a shooting. They were involved. That's a factual finding. The second thing is it occurred in the very same block near the defendant's residence, which goes towards the on or near the premises, and that they were then arrested. She testified she knew about the incident and had occurred.
So basically you're relying on the factual findings of the JP Court, which go to the substance of the offense as distinguished from the mere fact of an arrest for the offense. Is that correct?
Well, it's a tough issue, Your Honor.
I want to know whether that's correct.
I am relying in large part on the factual findings of the JP Court below because I believe that's what we're constrained to do.
Okay. My next question is, other than the investigative report, is there anything in the record in that 4-inch grouping of paper that you have on your side of the courtroom before the JP Court that would support those findings?
There are also newspaper clippings that were attached to the termination letter at the time it was forwarded, and they were admitted as part of the exhibit.
And those were hearsay, right?
Well, there was no hearsay objection, Your Honor, and they were admitted in the court below as attachments to the termination letter, and that, at the risk of going a couple steps beyond, there was a stipulation as to the receipt of the termination letter, but after the testimony, I then moved its admission in its entirety with the attachments, and there was no objection. So before the court were independent comments by the press, and I believe, I have to look for the site, that newspaper articles, as with certain limitations, are admissible.
Okay, so there were newspaper articles and the investigative report. Is there anything else?
The docket and Ms. Madre's testimony concerning the event.
Okay. Let's assume that there was no competent evidence to support the factual findings that were made by the JP Court, just for the sake of argument. My question is that evidentiary deficit a circumstance that the Superior Court or this court can take into account and review on a certiorari proceeding?
No.
So even if these factual findings have no foundation whatsoever, that is beyond the scope of any remedial review.
I believe that's a logical conclusion from the cases this court has ruled upon. I'm at about a minute left.
Did you want to speak to the jurisdiction issue?
I do, Your Honor. This, I think, is a perfect opportunity. It is, I think, at this point undisputed that there is a conflict between Newcastle County and Kent County on whether or not the court, Superior Court, has jurisdiction.
I guess we better leave it up to Sussex County.
Then. Yeah. Sussex County was about to walk into the fray, but the case was resolved before an opinion was issued. So we don't have the third court's interpretation. I am concerned, and I think other counsel is concerned, with the suggestion that there is somehow concurrent jurisdiction. Here's why I'm concerned. And I think Your Honors will recall in a related case on the same basic issue that the Justice of the Peace Court attempted to intervene and file some responsive things on the Howe case. And that is because this will create potentially five levels for a summary proceeding. If you look at the definition of what a summary proceeding is, it is not supposed to have five levels on it. Right now we have a single-judge trial. If you appeal, it's a matter of right. There doesn't have to be any error. You go to a three-judge panel. The sole, quote, appeal is a writ of cert, which is an extraordinary writ, and which has historically gone to Superior Court. If you say that a CCP, based on the general language of the reforming of the court, has concurrent jurisdiction, then if someone selects the CCP court and are unhappy with the results of a writ of cert, is that not then a final order, which is appealable to the Superior Court?
So your bottom line is Superior Court is the proper court to go up.
It is.
And not common pleas, not concurrently.
That is my bottom line here.
And would you, I know you're theoretically out of time, but I took some of your time earlier. Are you suggesting that practitioners generally not only want this issue resolved, as your colleague suggested, one way or another, but that the majority of practitioners you're suggesting would like Superior Court to be the final resting place for certiorari because of the possibility of an appeal from a certiorari ruling by common pleas to Superior Court?
The last issue is one that's been raised repeatedly with me, that would it in fact create another tier, create a five-tier process. And, you know, I have, you've heard reference to the Chelsea on the Square apartments. It's in both of our briefs. The counsel's here today who argued that, and he is waiting 20 months later on a summary possession case because CCP has not made a decision on whether they will or will not grant a writ of cert, because they're saying Judge Del Pesco said one thing, Judge Young said another. Maybe I have concurrent, maybe, I think the practitioners want some certainty on where it goes so that they know. And if it's concurrent, which I don't think it should be, they want to know that they have a chance to make a choice.
20 months, did I hear you say?
I believe that's right.
Okay.
I can confirm that.
Well, you won't be waiting 20 months from this, I can tell you.
Thank you, Aaron.
He is out of time, isn't he?
I'd be very brief.
I think you're out of time, actually.
If I reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Well, you used it in your opening argument.
I thought I tried to stop at the time in the court. Said
when the orange light came on, that was your rebuttal time.
Oh.
Sorry. Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and assess.